Let me tell you who's doing sneakers the best in the game right now. That's New Balance. The two-way V4, featuring this groundbreaking use of technology with fresh foam. It's called Fuel Cell, creating this combination that we love of rebound and cushioning. Fresh foam offers unparalleled cushioning for maximum comfort your entire game from start to finish. The upper construction features this lightweight textile that reduces weight, which we all need, I know I do, while remaining supportive and breathable. Hard to find that combo. The two-way V4 gives you the tools that you need to play at a high level. Learn more and purchase the two-way V4 at newbalance.com. Welcoming into the show, we've got our guy, Ryan McDonough. We're going to be asking him some of the inside baseball questions on the draft. I have not spoken ever to Ryan, so I'm happy to meet you. I'm super excited. Former GM of the Phoenix Suns, spent a decade working for the Boston Celtics, where he was everything from an international scout to assistant GM to my man, Danny, Trader Danny Ainge, currently our Odyssey Basketball Insider. That's where I'm from. Odyssey Basketball Insider. Cannot wait to ask him a ton of questions. How are you doing, sir?
Hey, Tristan, I'm doing well.
I want to, because there's a lot of people doing mocks. I'm not really too interested in like debating who's going to go where or who's the best fit where. I'm really interested in the process of drafting and just kind of how it all works from someone who's been there and has been there with a bunch of different teams. First and foremost, there's this big debate about team needs versus best available. What is your stance on that? And is that a trend that sort of changes over time? And what are some examples of ways that door one works and doesn't work and door two works and doesn't work?
Yeah, really good question. I think the first thing you have to ask as a franchise is, if player X in the draft is better, and he probably won't be better immediately, obviously these things take some time, but if he has a chance to be better than anybody on our roster, we should probably draft player X because we can move the other guys on the roster, you know, if he's that good, if he has a chance to be a special transcendent player. Now there are some arguments the other way. I mean, one of the things that we get criticized for, and you know, I certainly had some involvement with, was DeAndre Ayton with the number one pick in Phoenix. Thought process at the time, organizationally, right or wrong, and keep in mind I was fired the following preseason, so there may have been some disagreement, but was that we had a young backcourt star in Devin Booker, offensively gifted, struggled a little bit defensively and rebounding. He certainly improved in those areas, but the thought process was Devin in the backcourt, Ayton in the frontcourt, Mikal Bridges, who we later acquired on the wing. People can nitpick, and they certainly have, about the Luka Doncic versus Ayton pick, and I understand that, and I take responsibility for that. Obviously, the Suns were in the finals a year ago and won 64 games, so that's why it's so hard, Tristan. That's what I think people on the fan side or even some of the media side don't realize as much. You are picking for a team. You know, you're not just picking in a vacuum individually. And when people go back and do redrafts and things like that, the context and the roster at the time is important because, you know, the reality is once we get in October and training camp starts, you have to hand the coach the ball and say, figure out how to play these guys and put together a functional team. So, generally speaking, it's the most talented player. You'd want that. But there is some context and nuance to that as well.
I wasn't planning on asking you this, but I think one of the greatest steals in that draft was Mikal Bridges. Can you give me just a little bit of insight into how that all went down, if outside of what's already kind of been written about?
Yeah, it was a really unusual deal, Trista, just because Philadelphia 76ers, who had the 10th pick, drafted Bridges with the intention of keeping him.
I was at Barclays.
Okay, and you know Mikal's history and what it was like at Barclays. His mother worked for the franchise. He won multiple national championships at Villanova. He's a Philadelphia kid. And it seemed, you know, on paper, at least to me, like a very good fit between Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid. But Philly was big game hunting, I think. And we had a draft pick, a future first round pick that we got in 2015 for Goran Dragic from Miami that was unprotected. And then we had the 16th pick in the 2018 draft as well. So it's a bit unusual because, you know, I called Philly's front office. We were chasing picks up in that range because one of the things that I think people don't talk about enough, Trista, is there are tiers and gaps in the draft. And what I mean by that is, you know, the value of each player to the next is not always even, right? Sometimes it is close. Sometimes there's a gap between players. Sometimes there's a gap between tiers of players. So that's what teams do. It's there's like most teams use a tiering system rather than let's just rank them 1 to 60 or 100 or whatever. So with us, we felt the group of players in that late lottery, you know, say 8 to 14 range, were going to be significantly better than who was available or we thought was going to be available at 16. So anyway, so long story, relatively short, Philly drafted Bridges. I was on the phone with them, said, is there anything we can do? They said no at the time and said, okay, we're coming back at 16. We like Bridges a lot. We'd give you some value. We'd give you 16 plus, and we can discuss what the plus is, but are there players, you know, you guys are potentially interested in? And they said, yeah, one in particular. Obviously, they didn't tell us who it was. So fast forward to 14, 15, picking that range. We re-engaged with them, and Zaire Smith, the forward out of Texas Tech, was still on the board, who they liked. Obviously, Zaire's had some injury issues and other health issues that have derailed his career. But that plus the future Miami pick, that was how that deal got done. And this is funny in hindsight, especially given how well Mikel's done and how well the team has done, Trista. But I wasn't really looking forward to calling the kid and his mom, who were excited about being in Philly. And his mom works for the franchise, and saying, I know you thought you were going to stay at home, but what do you think about heading a couple thousand miles to the Southwest and becoming a Phoenix Sun?
That's wild. Another thing I think that people are interested in is, and I guess the context around it, are players like Shaedon Sharpe, players like Jaden Hardy. So two different paths, right? Both of those guys were consensus lottery picks. Shaedon doesn't end up playing a minute for Kentucky. Jaden Hardy goes to the G League. Shaedon Sharpe's kind of like a wild card in terms of his draft hasn't fell. I mean, we're not really sure. Maybe he's top five. Maybe he slips to mid, maybe post lottery. But Jaden Hardy seems to have fallen off a cliff in terms of consensus draft picks. Should players that are already deemed, Patrick Baldwin Jr. is another one, deemed to be a lottery pick, is there some sort of debate now on in terms of whether they should actually play in college or go to the G League or go the Shaedon Sharpe path?
Well, I speak from a, you know, former executive's perspective. I think they should play somewhere. I think it's one thing to try to manipulate draft stock and, you know, potentially hide, you know, things like that. But at the end of the day, as you know, Tristan, in fact, in just a couple of weeks, they're going to be up on a court in Las Vegas with ESPN and NBA TV and all these groups there, and they're going to have to perform. So yeah. I think, especially as a teenager, taking a year off and not playing is not something I would advise. Now, I really like what the NBA has done with the G League Ignite. That was one of my criticisms of the league or things I think the league could have done better earlier, instead of letting, and I'm going back a ways here, but instead of letting Brandon Jennings go play in Italy and Emmanuel Mudiay go play in China, recently LaMelo Ball go play in Australia, you know, a lot of us executives in the league were saying, why don't we keep these guys here? It's better from a fan and marketing perspective. It's better for the players developmentally. It's easier to recruit and evaluate them. And this is what the players want. Those guys, did, you know, 18, 19 years old, didn't want to go live overseas by themselves and things like that. So I bring it up because I think the league's done a terrific job with the G League Ignite. Just look at last year's draft. I believe they had two of the top seven picks. Jalen Green, who I think is going to be a star among the scoring leaders in the NBA someday. And then Jonathan Kuminga, who, you know, talented young developmental player for the Warriors, got some run in the playoffs on the NBA champion. And this year, Dyson Daniels will be another lottery pick. So I think it's, you know, it's good to have options. You know, Shaedon Sharpe's situation was unique. And the final, I guess, point I'll make on Shaedon, Trista, is that he is the kind of player as an executive that keeps you up at night. And what I mean by that is it scares you to take him because you don't have a body of work. And it also scares you to pass on him because of the talent. You know, he's talented enough. His highlight film is incredible. That kid could end up being the best pick in the draft. But that's why it's scary and hard to be an executive at this point. It'd be impossible to say either way where his career ends up.
Yeah, and Dre. And I would imagine that as a GM, job security makes that decision-making tree a little bit more complex. I'm curious, why do some guys skyrocket after the tournament has been over and we've gotten through the combine, we've gotten through team workouts? So it seems like nothing's really happened, right? And you take a guy like Mathurin. Mathurin was like in this like 11 to 15 range. And then all of a sudden now, even though he looked awesome at Arizona, went to the tournament, looked good there too, to go, why do some guys fall significantly and why do some guys skyrocket?
Really good question. And that's one of the things where, as evaluators, you have to remind yourself and keep going back to the film because, you know, at the end of the day, the games are a little bit different, college or international versus the NBA, but it's still 5-on-5 basketball. And after a guy's season's over, he's not really playing 5-on-5 basketball. He's doing the combo individually. You know, they do a little 5-on-5 there, but the recent trend, which is unfortunate, is the top players don't play there in the 5-on-5 action. And then the workouts, a lot of them, especially for the top prospects now, are individual 1-on-0. So that's one of the things. As an executive, you have to manage expectations. Frankly, it can be really dangerous, especially when the people who don't do this year-round, like your coaches, your head coach in particular, he has a strong voice, strong personality, and your owner, especially.
Yeah.
If you see a guy in an individual workout or, you know, as you know, Trista, anybody can 1 hour workout can look great or look horrible. It's not really reflective of who they are, but they can just have a great day or a horrible day. That's just, you know, human nature. So that's why you have to rely on your process. That's why you have to go back to the film and watch them play in games. And then also, you know, bake in some of the offseason stuff with the combine, with the individual workouts, and hope you make the right decision. But to answer your question, that is why. And I always get a kick out of when somebody says, a guy's stock is rising or falling or this or that. Well, in reality, it hasn't gone anywhere. Nothing has happened till tomorrow night. It's just, you know, media articles and things like that seem to manipulate players up and down. The teams just set their boards probably today as far as who they're going to draft. So anything that happened before today is, I don't say irrelevant, but I think, you know, it gets more traction on the media side than it does when you're working for a team.
Wait, so the draft board gets created only the day before the draft?
Usually do it pretty late, you know, probably the week of the draft. I'd be surprised if any teams did it well before this week, because as you look around the league, teams are still working out players as recently as, you know, Monday or Tuesday. I don't think we have any, you know, on Wednesdays we sit here about 24 hours before the draft. And the NBA does want the players to come to New York earlier now to do the media circuit and be available prior to draft night. But yeah, when I was in Boston in particular, because of the proximity to New York City, the draft is, you know, either Madison Square Garden or now the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, we would try to get guys in Wednesday morning. I mean, you know, the day before the draft and say, look, we know you're headed to the Northeast. We have to do some recruitment. We love your guy. Get him in here. It'll be the last workout. We'll take good care of him. We won't keep him long. We just want to see him one more time, and then we'll get him on the shuttle down to New York, you know, to be available for the draft. So that's why teams wait. And then also the medical piece of it, the intel. You want to go over that with your trainers, doctors, people like that one more time, Trista, just to make sure, because that's the other thing that keeps you up at night. One of the things as an executive, you draft a guy who's not medically sound, he breaks down. That's probably one of the quicker ways to get fired. If you drafted somebody, especially if you should have known and you didn't do your job as far as knowing whether the guy was medically fit or not.
You mentioned ownership and a bunch of different voices in the room. Can you kind of highlight just what it's like on draft night in a war room, all of the different people that are sounding off and kind of what your experience is like for people who haven't really had insight to that?
Yeah, it's certainly different with different franchises. I did probably 10 or 11 drafts in Boston and then 5 or 6 in Phoenix. You know, I ideally what you'd want is the top decision makers in the room, your head of basketball, whether the president or GM, his or her, you know, top lieutenants. And then same with the head coach, you know, the top men and women who work under the head coach, and then your owner. And really, that's it. I mean, you don't want a lot of, you know, theatrics and things like that. A lot of teams have draft parties in both places, in Boston and Phoenix. We did a good job of keeping that separate because, you know, you have to concentrate and be prepared to pivot for trades like the one we just discussed for Mikal Bridges. You know, you have to be prepared, obviously, to really do anything. And what I mean by that is you want to move up in the draft. Do you want to move down in the draft? Do you want to move out of the draft? Do you want to trade the pick for a player? Do you want to trade the pick for a future pick? You know, all that happens in real time and is fluid. And then you also, even as the draft is going, sometimes have to be prepared in case there's a slider. So that, you know, a guy you didn't think would be there, all of a sudden, you know, gravity sets in, the guy starts coming down, the player's nervous, his agent's calling you, and then you have to kind of go through your process to make sure you're prepared, you know, if he's on the board when it comes up. So really the most important people generally are the head of basketball, the head coach, and the owner. And, you know, the ownership involvement depends on the franchise and how involved or uninvolved that guy wants to be.
How many or what percentage of NBA teams have extremely vocal and hands-on owners during draft night?
I'd say a growing percentage, honestly. I think as franchise values escalate and some new money comes into the league, a lot of tech and a younger group of owners, I guess. I think some, talking to guys who've done the job longer than I have, some of the old guard owners, frankly, wouldn't come around for draft night. They just, get a call or you send them an email, maybe a fax back in the day, say, here are the guys we're looking at. You try to prep them for, we might take this guy or that guy. Okay, sounds good. That is getting, less and less standard, I guess, so they're more involved. So that's one of the challenges, from a front office perspective or a coaching perspective, I think from any job, right? Managing up, managing the boss and his expectations. I don't think that's a trend that's going anywhere. Let me put it this way. When the average franchise is selling for $1.5 to $2+ billion and guys write a check at that level, I think they're going to want to continue to be involved.
That's really interesting, especially considering I talked to somebody within the Golden State organization and I asked them, and I said, why do you guys consistently draft so well and find value wherever you're at in the board? And they said, well, I think the main reason, and they said a lot of people get it confused, like that there are certain teams that don't have great scouting departments or talent evaluation departments. There's pretty high level of talent evaluation all over the league, but it really is a matter of whether an owner decides they want to allow those decision makers and evaluators to have agency to make those decisions. And they said, Joe Lacob has really given us a lot of agency to make those decisions. What's it like when, maybe you see a decision one way and an owner disagrees?
Well, it's a challenge for sure. And I'd reiterate that. I've heard the same about Joe Lacob. He's an owner who's very involved in the process. Obviously, he's good at it. His team's been in the finals 6 of the last 8 years and won 4 championships. And I give him a lot of credit, Trista, because as much as, any majority owner I can think of off the top of my head, he works. I mean, he goes around, he scouts games, he watches film.
Yeah, he does.
He loves this stuff. He loves it. Yeah. And so where you get in trouble, you probably see where I'm going with this, but yeah, where you get in trouble is when a guy does not do all that and bases it off of, pre-draft workouts or highlight tapes or things like that and thinks he knows. Well, ultimately, he's the boss. So does he know? And so it's hard. I think like anybody, when you disagree with somebody you're working for, you need to be persistent and make your points and be respectful, but also know when to relent, right? Because ultimately, at the end of the day, unless you own a company or you're the CEO or whatever, you work for somebody. So you have to, pick your spots. You hope that the relationship you built up and the process you have is sound. Maybe if you have a track record of success doing something, you can fall back onto that. But I think anybody who's disagreed with the boss, goes through the same calculation. When do I push? How hard do I push? And when I realize it's not going to go my way or not likely to go my way, do I let go of the rope and relent, even if I don't agree with the ultimate decision?
I don't know if this happens at all, but when I disagree with someone for whatever decision, if I'm in a collaboration or I'm working for someone and I allow them to be the one and it does not work out or vice versa, it's pretty hard to not be like, well, you see, like, Frank Kaminsky really probably shouldn't have gone like whatever what was he, 13, 12 maybe?
I say no so quickly because I know who was the 13th pick in the 2015 draft.
Oh, yeah, it was Devin Booker, wasn't it? So I think Frank Kaminsky ended up going right before Devin Booker, didn't he?
I think Frank went 9th or 10th.
Yeah, 9th.
Range, maybe 11. The direct pick before Devin was his college teammate, Trey Lyles, with the Utah Jazz. And this is why it's so hard. I mean, Dennis Lindsay and his staff did a phenomenal job of building the Jazz when he was there. They drafted Donovan Mitchell in the late lottery and Rudy Gobert in the late first round. They had also drafted Rodney Hood, who played well at the time, late teens, early 20s there. So they had a perimeter-heavy team. They wanted a front court guy. They went with Lyles over Booker. In a vacuum, that pick doesn't look great. But then you look at the totality of their draft. Like, yeah, Utah, they've been one of the best teams in the league the last few years. So that's why the job is hard, Tristan. And obviously one of the frustrations, as you can imagine, and players get this too, but as an executive, as a head coach, for certain members of fans in particular, certain members of the media, just pick at a mistake rather than looking at the totality of it and saying, okay, it's a hard job. And nobody, literally, whether you're Red Auerbach or Jerry West, everybody's going to make mistakes. The guys who do it better make fewer mistakes and adjust to their mistakes quicker than everybody else.
So I heard this story yesterday, and I believe it was Mark Stein talking about the Dirk draft pick. And he was talking to the Mavericks organization and asked them how Dirk did. And they basically said that Dirk had a horrible workout. And that this other kid, I forget who it was, really excelled. And, it was disappointing because they liked Dirk and all of this. obviously they end up loving Dirk. That was a complete lie. And Dallas, the Mavericks organization, said to Mark, don't listen to us at all before a draft because it's all lies. Can you talk a little bit about the whole disinformation campaign that goes on pre-draft from team to team in the media, how, you know, how front offices use media to sort of like take you off the scent, and who's the best at it in the league right now?
Yeah, all really good questions, Trista. Look at it this way. If you work for a team, why would you want anybody to know what you're doing, right? Yeah. You wouldn't want anybody to know what you're doing because there goes your competitive advantage. And in this draft that's coming tomorrow night, I think the Orlando Magic have done a good job injecting some uncertainty into the process. I mean, most people think they're going to take Jabari Smith, the forward out of Auburn. I think that's who they'll take. I wouldn't be shocked if they take Chet Holmgren personally. Now we've seen on the betting markets, and I know, obviously, given your multiple gigs with Odyssey, you follow the betting markets closely, Paolo Banchero has skyrocketed. He was a distant third on the betting markets. Now he's moved up just behind Chet Holmgren into that number three slot, close to number two. So, I mean, they're doing a good job of that. Now, we'll see ultimately all that matters to the franchise is whether they draft the right guy and how he develops. But, yeah, if you're Orlando, for example, you want people thinking you could take any of those three guys or maybe even Jaden Ivey, because if a team falls in love with a player, you don't want them to say, okay, well, we know Orlando's going to take Jabari Smith, for example. Now let's just talk to Oklahoma City at two and try to trade for two because we know who won it. You know, you want all your options to be open. So that's why it happens. And, yeah, the disinformation, it's easy on the team side to spot a lot of times because when you see stuff about your own team, you say, well, that's not true. You know, it's you know, obviously, when you're living it, when you're doing it. And so what I would say, just from a general perspective for your fans, is consider the sources, right? I mean, some of the NBA's top newsbreakers, you and I know a lot of them, but Bedrian Morjanovsky, Shams Charania, some of these guys say it's probably pretty legitimate. If it's some guy who's an egg with six followers on Twitter, you probably don't want to listen to that person if it is a person and not a bot. So that's the challenge. You know, teams will use it to throw out smoke screens. Agents will use it to try to, as you talked about, players rising or falling, especially try to spike their guy's value right before draft time and prevent a free fall on the other side of it. So as far as teams, honestly, I think just about every team does it. And then, you know, one of the new trends is interesting. I guess this is more related to free agency, but I was thinking of today is one of the things we're seeing now, Trista, is teams using the media to set the expectations for free agency, right? So it's, for example, a recent example in the last 24 hours, PJ Tucker opts out in Miami with the Heat. We see that the Philadelphia 76ers will offer PJ Tucker a 3-year, $30 million deal, and that the Miami Heat better be prepared to, you know, pay that amount. So that's kind of the
that's
way
it's coming the game from the agent side, yes? That's got to be coming from the agent side, right?
I think it's both. Honestly, I think a lot of it probably is the agent side. You know, he's doing what's best for his player. That's his job. But a lot of it's the team side, too, where if you're PJ Tucker, so I didn't know that team was interested in at that level. Let me start. I was thinking about maybe re-signing in Miami. You know, I'm comfortable here. We just went to the Eastern Conference Finals, almost played in the NBA Finals. It's South Beach, no state income tax, all those kind of things. But Philly's interested. Well, they have James Harden and Joel Embiid. And, you know, so that's kind of the way the game is played now, as Draymond calls it, the new media. And I don't think that's a trend that's going to change, not only with players, you know, doing media like Draymond and CJ McCollum, but with teams and agents and even players leaking stuff to try to manipulate situations the way they want it to go.
What percentage of what we've seen rumor-wise, specifically this year, considering it's a very wide open draft, would you consider to be false?
Oh, more than half. You know, I think, you know, a lot more than half.
That's a lot.
But because, you know, honestly, one of the things that's funny with NBA teams is they'll spend just about all their time talking about what every single other team's going to do. And then, you know, when you ask somebody, what are you guys going to do? It's, well, you know, I'm not sure, you know, because there's no reason to tell another team what you're going to do, you know. So I think that perpetuates it. You know, where kids like the game telephone, where you tell the person next to you and then they tell the next person. And by the time it got to the end of the line, the message was kind of similar, but like pretty different. That's kind of like the NBA where, you know, you hear this team is interested in this guy or may do this. And then it gets, you know, parroted and maybe changed and tweaked a little bit. And by the time sometimes it hits the media or it gets back to you, you say, wait a minute, that's not what it's kind of like what I heard, but different. So there is a lot of that in NBA front offices. And that's why I think in some ways, honestly, it's a little bit of a waste of time to do all that. If you're an NBA executive or with a team, just, you know, focus on what you're doing, the draft, the film, the trades. Don't worry about it, you know, and just rely on your direct conversations with other teams rather than what you read on Twitter or some of these NBA gossip sites.
if we're betting on the NBA draft, if you're in a state where you can bet, does it make sense to look at kind of the past decision-making lens of an organization and in terms of how they like to draft, how they like to construct a roster, in terms of how they may actually select? A good example that I guess I could use is, like, there's a lot of chatter around Toronto last year taking Jalen Suggs. But when you look at Masai Ujiri and what he likes to do, he likes to get these 6'6 to 6'10 guys that can switch everything, that can also handle the ball, with exception, obviously, to Fred VanVleet, which makes the Scottie Barnes pick make more sense.
Yeah, really good question. And so I don't want to say disregard what I said up until this point, but if there is a time, especially if you're betting it, to rely on NBA insiders, the elite NBA insiders, newsbreakers, it is in the next 24 hours from now up until the draft, because that was one of the things that I got, you know, for Odyssey. I think it was in 2020, the draft, that they were going to take, the Chicago Bulls were going to take Patrick Williams with the fourth pick. I had a number of people tell me that. I think he would have gotten good value there in the betting markets because he was not a projected top four pick. So I say, you know, pay attention to some of that, like, now. You know, the other 363 or 4 days, it's less relevant. But generally, the mock drafts, especially Jonathan Givony runs one for ESPN, are pretty accurate, close to the draft. So I would pay attention to those. And then, yeah, to your point, the team history. I'll give you another example that's, probably to me the most interesting thing in the draft tomorrow night is the Sacramento Kings at 4. They have De'Aaron Fox on the roster, max player. They drafted Davion Mitchell a year ago, which was controversial because at that time they had Tyrese Halliburton on the roster. They traded Halliburton, obviously, for Sabonis with Indiana. Will they do it again? Will they draft Jaden Ivey again? He's the best player on the board, in my opinion. He may be the best player to come out of this draft. I wouldn't be surprised, but I think there's maybe some value in if you can get those kind of odds. I don't know if you can, Trista, but like Jaden Ivey with the fourth pick, not necessarily Jaden Ivey to Sacramento, but, you know, with the fourth pick, I think there's probably some good value there because I think he probably does go number 4, whether that's Sacramento or another team swooping in by a trade.
You were an international scout. I just watched The Hustle with Adam Sandler. So I have a newfound appreciation for all the miles that you've logged in your life and all of the room service and places you've woken up and you don't even know where you are. I am curious, based on your international experience, how places and regions and styles of play go in and out of style. You talk about a bunch of NBL guys or guys from Australia in general, like Giddy, that have ripped things up early, you know, made an immediate impact. How does that impact other, like, decision makings and how other players from that area and how teams evaluate them?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think if you go back 30 years, what the Dream Team started is really powerful and impactful. And you see that as an international scout. In fact, you know, look at the recent award winners in the NBA. You know, 2-time MVP now, Nikola Jokic from Serbia. Before that, Giannis, born in Nigeria, raised in Greece, maybe the best young player in the league, Luka Doncic from Slovenia, Pascal Siakam, I believe he recently won most improved player from Cameroon. So it really is a worldwide game, you know, globally. We've talked about Dirk on this show. We could talk about, you know, Yao Ming and other international players over the last couple decades as well. So I think that's a good thing for the league. And I think, one of the ways, honestly, that you see the rest of the world catching up to the USA and why it's so important to scout internationally is just watch Team USA play. This is not, Bird and Jordan and Magic and those guys beating Angola by 100 points in 1992. You know, these international countries, a lot of the top ones are pretty good. You know, you watch Spain or, some of the top international teams, they really push the American guys. So I think, you know, that'll continue. I think the next region, honestly, that the NBA is invested in is Africa, you know, where they have the Basketball Africa League. A lot of times, or most of the time, historically, the top African players, like Serge Ibaka, for example, have left. They played in Europe, and then they come over to the U.S. So the NBA is really trying to develop the African continent. But, yeah, if you're in that role, you're in the Adam Sandler international scouting role, you better have your passport ready with the extra pages in that book to get, more stamps. And you better get a lot of frequent flyer miles, because it's not like you're just scouting the U.S. or just going to Europe like you could in the past. Yeah, you're probably going to, you know, Oceania, they call it, New Zealand, Australia, Asia, and then probably sometime in the future, you're going to Africa as well.
My Lord. I want to talk a little bit about, and I know you got to get out of here, but I got like 3 more, about teams that are looking to, like, trade their picks. And they need immediate impact guys. a current role player. I'm thinking about Portland specifically. I have promised Dame that they're going to retool. A lot of chatter about them trading that pick to get OG Anunoby or a John Collins, and the disinformation campaign now is alive and well that they're going to keep that 7 pick. Help me understand why a team would go one direction. We're going to trade the pick and get a current role player. That's, you know, we need to win now. And then they do an about face and they keep that pick.
I think because Trista ultimately is an executive, your job for the franchise is to do what's best given what's available, right? You can want to do whatever. I mean, every executive in the league would love to put together, you know, a super team of all-stars at every position. That's obviously not realistic. But, you know, a lot of times, like in life, you can only make the decisions that are in front of you. You can't force something that's not there. So yeah. I think Portland probably does want to trade the number 7 pick. It seems like they have told Damian Lillard, to your point, that, this is not going to be a long, drawn-out rebuild. He's in his 30s now. He's made a ton of money. He's an All-NBA player. He's going to the Hall of Fame someday. He doesn't have the patience for that.
Yeah.
Nor would it be prudent for the Trailblazers to keep Lillard in a Blazers uniform if they're going to do that. You know, it makes sense to get young players and draft picks and things like that. So that's but the challenge is, you know, you don't want to trade the 7th pick for just whatever, you know, for anybody if he's not going to impact winning. The other school of thought is, okay, you know, we'd prefer to trade the pick. I imagine the Blazers have a list of players they would trade the pick for. But if you can't get one of those players, you know, then let's try to draft the best available guy we can. Maybe he shows out in summer league and builds value there, and we could trade him, you know, later this summer or even into the season next year. Keep in mind the trade deadline's not till February. So those are the decisions that take place. And you know, on draft night, that's why the best executives, the best teams are flexible. I think one of the best recent examples of that is Golden State and the maneuvering they did with D'Angelo Russell first and then with Andrew Wiggins and the pick. I don't think that was something that they necessarily could have predicted in advance, but they gave themselves that optionality and flexibility, and it culminated in Wiggins being maybe the second best player on the team that just won the championship.
Yeah, that was a wild turn of events, man. For him to turn into Maple Jordan after being, you know, somewhat disappointing in Minnesota, it goes to show you that, you know, Steve Kerr said that, you know, that the majority of NBA players could be impact players if they were in the right situation. Do you think that's true?
It's not something that we discuss enough. Situation, role, fit. And what I would say, Trista, is there are only a handful of guys in the NBA that, in my opinion, are that 1A alpha guy that, you know, you hang on the marquee, you sell tickets, people come, visiting fans come to see that guy play. There aren't many of those guys. There certainly aren't 30 of them. And so if you're Andrew Wiggins, who, as you know, is backstory, son of Mitchell Wiggins, former NBA player, one of the anointed ones from a young teenager, this kid was the number one player and potential NBA star. It's hard to live up to that pressure and those expectations, especially when you are drafted number one by Cleveland and then traded, you know, for Kevin Love to Minnesota, and the Timberwolves and their fans expect that. So I just think of it from Wiggins' perspective. Going from a guy who's expected to be the guy and lead Minnesota championships, obviously the Timberwolves are well short of that. He gets traded, as a quote unquote disappointment in the eyes of a lot of people to Golden State. In fact, I'm not saying that's pick on Wiggins, but keep in mind that Minnesota threw in a pick that ended up being Jonathan Kuminga, the 7th pick in the draft, along with Wiggins, gives you an idea of his value at the time.
Right.
To now, he's the 4th guy in Golden. He's not the guy anymore. We know who that is. That's Steph Curry, the best shooter in the history of the game. But they also have Draymond Green and Klay Thompson, who are also head of the Hall of Fame someday. So now Wiggins can just be himself. He can just play his role. He's not the focal point. He's not the guy that everybody in the media and the fans wants to hear from. He's not the center of the defensive game plan. In fact, he's probably not even the second, or maybe he's probably the third guy in the game plan when you're playing against Golden State. And he's thrived, you know, so like, I think that's what Kerr is referring to. It is situation, it is opportunity, and the teams that usually win have that, you know, 1A alpha guy at the top, and then everybody falls in line behind him.
I think one of the most complicated evaluation decisions, I guess, of this draft seems to be Chet, right? Chet Holmgren from Gonzaga, 7-footer, elite shooter, elite shot creator, elite passer, defender, really good shot blocker, probably one of the most unique unicorn type players that we've seen, so they say, right? But he's 195 pounds, has all the tools. My question to you is, do you think that Chet's frame can functionally work at the NBA level with this full toolbox of skills if he does not put on another pound?
No, he needs to add weight. And this is why, one of the reasons why the job is so hard, I think, at least in my opinion, clearly Chet Holmgren has the most upside of any player in this draft with his size, his length, his shooting potential, his shot blocking. I think he blocked 3.5 shots a game at Gonzaga in 26 minutes. He can be a unicorn. But is he going to be healthy? Is he going to make it, so to speak? And we've seen guys with unusual bodies. I don't want to scare anybody, especially Orlando Magic fans, but Greg Oden broke down. Recently there's some questions, I think valid questions, about Kristaps Porzingis and his long-term health. Is Chet going to be one of those guys, or is he going to have a successful 10 or 15-year career? And honestly, Trista, that's part of the reason the job is so hard, that as an executive, you really have to rely on your medical staff, your doctors and trainers, sports scientists. I imagine the Magic in particular, probably OKC as well, has put Holmgren through a battery of tests and gotten his medical information and dissected it. And it's like anything else, it's a projection. Is this guy going to hold up? Is there anything chronically wrong with him? And then it's like building a house with his frame. How much can you add to it before it potentially crumbles or falls apart? So I think those are legitimate questions. Let me put it this way. I think if Chet Holmgren's body were, solid, like, he'd be the number one pick for sure. But I think that is a legitimate question and a reason why you may see Jabari Smith go off the board if Orlando doesn't want to take that risk.
Last question about Jaden Ivey. For him, what I've seen is that he has a ton of skills physically, right? And very explosive athlete, but the one question mark is his decision-making ability. And a bet on him is really truly a bet on whether you can develop him into being this really good decision-maker, a playmaker, and find the ability to drive and kick well, right? He's made some pretty bad shots in the tournament, kind of taking bad twos and threes when he can make the open look. So I guess the question is, how do teams evaluate on the front end whether a player you can do that with him, and whether they're capable of getting better on the IQ and decision making side?
Yeah, a lot of it's the in person scouting and the film work. You really want to get technical and break it down, especially the pick and rolls, as that's such an important part of today's NBA game. Yeah. And then it's decision making. And one of the things we did when I was GM of the Suns is when we met with players, we would pull film clips of their games and then have them talk us through what they saw, what they were thinking. Obviously there's some good plays mixed in with some bad plays. You want to see how a player thinks the game and how he talks through it. And then you also, frankly, you have to evaluate the whole roster and the coaching staff and things like that as well, because if a player was used a certain way before getting the NBA, but you're not going to use them that way, keep in mind, usually, as you know, Trist, especially compared to Big Ten basketball at Purdue with Ivy, the NBA game can be faster. It can be more open. It's actually less physical. I think that's counterintuitive to some people, but there's less contact on the ball handler. So that's part of the reason I'm a fan of Jaden Ivey. I really like the kid's potential. I think with the NBA now, with hand checking basically disallowed, whereas a defender, you can't really put your hands on a guy. I think it's going to be really hard for people to stay in front of that kid. And that's why, I see shades of Ja Morant. You're right. The decision making has to improve. I see flashes of a young John Wall. He just moves at a different speed with the ball. And given his background, too, keep in mind his mother, Yale, was an excellent player, coached with the Grizzlies, now the head coach at Notre Dame. This kid's, comes from an athletic family and a basketball family. And watching him play and seeing him interviewed, he seems like a pretty sharp guy. So for me, just from afar, I think he'll be able to figure it out. I think he has a lot of things you can't teach, and he seems certainly smart enough and willing to learn the things you can't teach as an NBA team.
One follow-up. Is that what you saw with Devin Booker?
Some similarities. Yeah. Obviously, Devin didn't have the freaky athleticism. He had the beautiful shot. I think what stood out to us more than anything, Trista, was the competitiveness. I mean, we saw the shooting in Kentucky, but then when we brought him into our gym for a pre-draft workout, the hyper-competitiveness, he didn't want to lose a drill, nobody could stop him. And then when we did some two-on-two or three-on-three in particular, you saw some of the ball handling and playmaking that, if you go back and watch the high school film, it was there, but that was not his role at Kentucky. So that's part of the reason the job is hard, right? If you just watched him at the Wildcats, you say, well, he's an excellent catch-and-shoot player. What else can he do? Well, he was first team All-NBA guy. He can do a lot, but that wasn't obvious at the time. Really, that pre-draft process helped to solidify that he was the guy, and luckily he was there at 13 in the 2015 draft.
Yeah, it's interesting how situations sometimes can throw teams off the scent. I think Duke is really good at hiding players to what they can be. I think Paolo could be a star. It just was kind of used in a different way than maybe he'll be used in the NBA. But Awesome stuff. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate you giving me a plethora, a swath of your very valuable time. I hope we can do it again soon.
Anytime, Trista. Always great to be on with you.
Thanks so much. Appreciate that. That was Ryan McDonough, former GM of the Phoenix Suns, assistant GM of the Celtics, former international scout, current Odyssey NBA and basketball insider. Awesome stuff. Like, I'm going to go back and listen to that and listen some more. So I'm really happy that he gave us his time. I actually am out of time. I got to run as well. I'll give you guys some more post-draft insight, quick wild cards, things that I think might or may not happen. I still have some things I want to say about Pat Baldwin and Shaedon Sharpe and Jeremy Sochan and some others. But thank you to our guest, Ryan McDonough. He was very generous with his time. Find us on the podcast if you want to listen to that back wherever you get them. That's the Heat Check. That is all the time that we have for Heat Check. We will be back Friday with a live episode recapping all the draft news. Follow us from Heat Check as the season comes to an end and free agency begins. Do not forget to download, subscribe, tell your friends, every single one of them. Please follow us on social at this Heat Check and at Trista Crick on TikTok.